Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Fred. I am responsible. I am accountable. I am capable of assisting people to find their true voice and then deliver it effectively into the world around us. With 40 years in mental health, 32 of them as a psychiatrist, and then a massive amount of conversations, including podcasting and expert speaking, keynote speaking, I have the opportunity to really see the magic that it takes to find one's authentic self and then deliver it effectively into the world. And if you're like me, you can see that now more than ever, that's what's called for. So today is that day. Now is that time. Come forth. Join me in the broadcast. You'll see on the other side of this at True Voice with Dr. Fred. Sam.
You're alive.
Yeah, barely. How you feeling?
Feeling all right.
Good.
Probably better than you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe. For the first time in a while, I think physically I'm feeling worse than you are most of the time.
What the hell, dude? You left me hosting two of these podcasts on my own.
Yeah, I appreciate you doing that. I hope you had fun with that.
Yeah, I had a great time.
Yeah.
Great time. Yeah. Yeah.
We're trying to do something with, you know, repurposing these things and actually make them useful. Even after the day that we do them, you know, because we got the StreamYard, you know, the streaming thing, because there's thousands of people packed up with their ears next to their microphones, next to their, in our headphones, like making sure they don't miss a word of this. Everyone knows that's happening. So the next piece is to really make sure that afterwards, the people that were unfortunate enough to have missed it, have a real opportunity to capture, you know, what the essence of these conversations is about.
So you decided that life was not interesting enough without flirting with death a little bit, yeah? Is that the whole deal? I mean,
I'm ready to take this on today. I'm, you know, be gentle is all I ask, somewhat gentle about the truth of what we're fucking talking about here.
And the only reason I have a big smile on my face is because I know you as well as I do.
Yeah, no, I'm okay with really taking this on today. And the idea is, you know, this really happened. And it's a little different than when we talk about things that could have happened or we fantasize and get all gooey and gory and shit. Like, this really did happen in the last few weeks. So it is something. And
you want to elaborate?
I'm not sure what the premise was that you said that life was too boring the way it was, so I decided to flirt with death. Is that what you suggested?
Something along those lines. You seem to be, from everything I know about you, a guy who wants to really, live life to its fullest, get every experience you possibly can out of this experience, you know, really suck get the juices out of life. And this recent adventure seems to be really taking it to a next level.
Yeah, that's one way to look at it.
Do you want to elaborate on it so that we can get some context for your recent experience? Because I know that I know about it, but not a whole lot of other people do.
Yeah, well, a couple Mondays ago, I was doing my workout in the morning, and I did a pretty big wide stretch. A full stretch, and I felt something change instantly in my body. And I felt like I lit up like a pinball machine, like bam, 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 bam. I could hear and feel like I've never felt before, my heartbeat, just rocking my entire existence. And then my trainer asked me if there was, you know, if I was in a cramp. I'm like, no, Demel, it's not a cramp. It's my heart. And I can almost see, as I look back to it, I can almost see the written letters, H-E-A-R-T in capital, bam, with each pump. And I think I could see it. And he said, well, where's Alexandra? And I was in the shower, so luckily she was up and awake and not very far away. And I walked back into the bedroom. I'm like, Alex, I need some help. Got some heart trouble. And she heard that and popped out of the shower. And then I knew I was in some dire straits. And I wanted to take a shit. I thought maybe that could somehow help.
And I think that those are two connected organs, the colon and the heart. Yeah. Basically shit out your heart trouble.
I really wanted to just push something out.
Yeah.
And I did sit on the toilet and did something. I pushed as hard as I could. I'm not sure if I made things worse, but at the point I didn't even care. You know, I didn't care if it was ripping me into shreds. And it didn't work very much. And then I started thinking like a doctor and realized what this had to be, what I learned in medical school, which was a dissecting aortic aneurysm. And what that is a tube that leaves the heart, that as the main artery that leaves the heart is called the aorta. And that aorta, before it goes too far, it sends the two carotid arteries up into your head and then sends a couple arteries down your arms. But really, in the end, it's on the way down to your femoral arteries, you know, your leg arteries and all the stuff that needs to be arterialized and oxygenated elsewhere in your body. And if that highway, that main highway, gets overfilled or overstressed, in certain situations, it'll dissect like a bad pair of pants right down the seam. And that's what happened, apparently. So blood was no longer effectively going down the highway to the rest of my body. And it was being released into my chest and belly. And so that's an emergency, to say the least. That's not
going to say the least.
It's not going to cure that minute. It's not going to take care of itself.
So when this happens, how many hours does someone typically have to live before intervention?
The surgeon that I eventually ran up with told me that 6.5 hours is the longest that they expect people to live.
Uh-huh.
And I went 6 hours. So I feel very fortunate that my body still works today. You know, there's still some discomfort, but on that day, by the time we called 911 and then realized that our local hospital didn't have all the tools necessary to actually carry on the surgery that was required, and then made some phone calls to put me in an ambulance and take me to a place that could theoretically do that. And that's where I ran into Dr. Rodriguez, who was just one of the finest heart surgeons in Sacramento, maybe in California or the world. I don't know. He's a pretty well-trained man. And for some reason, he was waiting around for a case like mine to do that day. So I was put into an ambulance. Alex couldn't join me. She went by a car behind us. And I started feeding me some pain meds and stuff and trying to keep me conscious. So we had conversations that I barely recall. And I made it to the hospital and I wanted Alex to be there, because when I met Rodriguez, kind man with these bullseye eyes, you know, big brown blazing eyes. I said, what are we looking at here, doc? And he said, we're looking at a procedure that has 40% mortality if I do it right. And I said, well, that's big numbers, dude. You know, that's big numbers. And I said, I can't proceed until my wife hears that. So we had to wait for her. And I can tell now, you know, because of that distance between 6 and 6.5 hours, he was getting nervous about the whole situation. It was already 5.5 or 6 hours. And then Alex came. I remember touching base with her. you know, in the meantime, they had done everything they could to prep me. They'd shaved my whole body and given me tests and put tubes and needles and shit places that didn't want, aren't necessarily welcoming of those. And off I went. And I had surgery that the Monday all day, the rest of the day. And I guess he was happy with the results, but he called Alex and told her that he was happy with the results overall. But then there was some mild bleeding into my belly. So we had to go back in. I didn't remember that. I didn't know that I went twice. But they took me back in the OR and stitched up my belly. It went in there in what's called an exploratory laparotomy. So they could see where the mesenteric arteries, how they were being fed. Because if your intestine dies, then you die. Back to what you were saying about the colon and the heart, the essence of the intestine. And so he was really happy with whatever he did there. Extremely happy. He had to put in one stitch, and whatever that stitch, he called it like a magical stitch. He was very, very, very happy with that surgery. And, you know, sent me off back into the ICU to recover. And that's what I did over, you know, and then my next wake up was in the ICU as I was kind of sprawling around, trying to figure out how to sleep or get some rest or do whatever I was supposed to do, but pretty disconnected from my body. And, I had a couple male nurses that did their very best. They were both really good, but they had to do a lot of stuff for me in order to be good. You know, they had to clean up bowel incontinence on several occasions, and they did so with just such grace. But the bed was only like 5'8" long, and I'm 6'3", so that was a real problem. I couldn't really open up. It was really a huge issue, actually. I made it through the morning and eventually complained about the size of the bed, and they brought a bigger bed, but the bigger bed was only about 6'1". So it was slightly bigger, but it wasn't as big as me. And I kept on, you know, doing whatever I was doing and trying to learn how to turn and how to set up my blankets and, you know, how to pee or how to poop or how to call for help or how to cough. Or all those things. And eventually I started hearing from people that I was recovering well, which was kind of astonishing to me. I'm like, wow, this is called good? Yeah, that's interesting.
So what did it feel like from your experience at that time?
You know, I was like, well, I believe you, but I still felt very crunched and unaware of my body, unaware of how things were going, or, you know, I knew my spirit was alive, but I didn't know, I didn't understand how this could be good. But I immediately, as soon as they said it was good, I bought it. I was like, no problem, this is good. And I think I became more demanding. I got sent up to the next step down unit. I figured they were sending me to the step down unit because they needed another ICU bed. And that they told me that I was doing good so that somehow we could justify that move. I wasn't sure it was really true. So they moved me to the next step down unit, the progressive care unit. And there again, I complained a little bit. I started seeing that I was like a normal patient there. There was like lots of rooms and a few different nurses and all. And there was a possibility if I lied down diagonally, I could almost fit in this bed. And I had one doctor say to me, if your biggest problem is the size of the bed, then you must be recovering very well. And my point of that is, no,
That's a huge, you are underestimating the importance of having a bed that fits you. Really important. But I said it again, and some angel, this woman who I befriended over the next several days, my housekeeper, heard me say it and scurried away and came back with what she called the Bentley of beds. And this thing was big enough. It was big enough. It was like built for real people. It was built for big men. And you know, it was wider and longer and more comfy and more padded. And it could raise on the bottom, raise on the top, and raise in the middle. So I actually could find myself in various configurations that weren't available with the previous bed. And it actually felt like my recovery started then. I would like to tell her that. If I found her, I would tell her that. Then I started realizing, well, I might be able to really get through this. I started being able to, you know, sit up a little bit in order to pee into my urinal and gain some control and even enjoy some breakfast. And or I don't know about you've been to the hospital a lot. And I think our customers know that by now, but you know, I grew a major affection to applesauce and tapioca pudding. Like they were both fucking great. Oh my God. Those little cups of applesauce and vanilla pudding. And also they had Jell-O. But they didn't stop serving me solid food. So they'd give me like an egg and an English muffin in the morning and a scrambled egg. And it was pretty lousy. You know, I'd work through it. Or meatloaf for lunch or something, or pork chop, or, you know, there was some dietary restrictions. But day after day, I started realizing that I was making gains somehow. You know, I craved oxygen, so I was having trouble opening my lungs. Even today, a little bit of trouble still opening my lungs full way. Better today than any day so far, for sure. I've had a couple of very full breaths today. It's really good. And I knew that oxygen was making life a little easier for me. So the cannula, nasal cannula, of oxygen, but as soon as I reached for that, then the nurses or the doctors would think that I was now becoming oxygen dependent. And they'd say, you know, we're going to have to wean you from that before you get out of here. So I knew it wasn't really a good addiction to come after that oxygen, but it was really helpful. And the same, a similar thing happened with my pain meds. They had started me off on a bunch of fentanyl and then went to Percocet. And then there was some others like Oxycontin, and then there was one other one, Darvocet or something. I'm not sure, something like that. And each time I took those, it sort of kind of deflected the pain, but not really. You know, the experience is not, it doesn't really alter the pain. It kind of just gives your mind less capacity to focus on the same pain. And so it feels like relief, and then it becomes really, yeah, I can see how people get dependent on that stuff pretty quickly. So over the next several days, I started using that a little bit less. And then one day woke up to the notion that in order for me to heal, I need to stop using extra oxygen and I need to stop using pain meds altogether and just deal with it. So that's what I did for a day, about a week later. So Sunday, day six. And then things got... Things got a little bit better and then a little bit more better and more better. And then my blood pressure. The key here is that apparently blood pressure is a factor. You know, what blows open the aorta is something they call high blood pressure, uncontrolled high blood pressure. And as a doctor, I hadn't had a lot of respect for what that even means. I don't really respect systolic and diastolic. It seems like one of the stupider tests in all of medicine that has lots and lots of stupid tests. But this one never made a lot of sense to me. And I didn't know why those numbers should mean anything. But I feel like I now have a respect for that. I've been started on medicines that now are intended to keep my blood pressure low. I've always known I've had sort of, you know, that whenever I had to have my blood pressure taken, that it was likely to be high. But it hasn't, you know, today I got my staples taken out of my belly and I went right down to Sacramento earlier today and got, you know, staples properly taken out. And my blood pressure was good and low. And I know what that feels like. I see how that's a totally different experience of life than the one that's driven by high blood pressure. And you and I have talked a little bit about that, but this whole idea of a high blood pressure lifestyle is what splits open the seams in the pants at the aortic level. That I can see that if blood is rushing hard down those arteries, and there's too much blood moving too fast with too much force, then it's going to bust a nut, and that's what happened. And so I have respect for low blood pressure now. I'm not sure I have respect for the medicines that are supposedly driving it. I think there are better ways to achieve low blood pressure. But I'm going to do what they say for a while here and make any kind of transfers gradual, you know, by diet or by there's ways to manage high blood pressure that are very well documented that has very little to do with laboratory medications that are loaded with problems. And over the last several days, I've just been getting myself better and better physically and better emotionally and carrying on with my coaching clients and dealing with the fears of the world personally and communally. Like, I have a new way of looking at the difficulties in the world. Whereas
talk before, about that.
Yeah. Well, like before, I think before, you know, I would do something in the world of high driving, counterbalancing, sex, drugs, rock and roll, you know, like not that there's anything wrong with those things, but when used to counterbalance the disturbance, it doesn't really assist. It only gives a sense. So if I have a shot of tequila or a bong full of hookah or whatever, you know, and even sexual outlets, it feels like I deserve it. The world's so fucked up and I'm counterbalancing it with some sort of self-serving, like made up, fabricated comfort. And I now, those things do not even look interesting to me at this moment. And what's here is like, you know, Alexandra is, I have an angel for a wife. That is so sure. And what she's calling for and what we've been built on from the very first minute we met, well, maybe not the first minute, once we realized that that hating each other as much as we did meant that we could have a relationship. What we've been built on is 100%, is delivering true and honest 100% with each other. And I feel like we're really going at that at a whole new level right now. What does that really mean for me to be kind and gentle and delicate and also powerful and listening and masculine and all of these things, letting it all flow down the pipe? It's almost like my pipe has become available for more volume of humanity. Without fear of it ready to burst, like it has a flexibility. I have a Dacron aorta now. And I'm not so worried about it bursting. And, you know, instead I'm really, like I said at the start of the conversation, I'm really taking on, you know, my fears, my financial fears or my future fears or my physical fears or my love fears or my, you know, not just fears, but fears or discomfort or dismay or you know, like any kind of any kind of wishing that life was different than it was. Like I'm now taking it on in ways that seem much more solid and honest and true to what's real, instead of hopping over it, you know, looking at it for a split second, the shrapnel in my life. And then instead of taking responsibility for it, just counterbalancing it with a virtual shot of tequila. It isn't like I was drinking a bunch of tequila. I don't mean to suggest that. There's a lot of all those things I was listing, I'm calling virtual shots of tequila. Instead, there's like a willingness to open my arms, almost like corpse position in yoga, and just accept the world totally as a way of handling the depression and the fear and the anxiety of what it really means to be alive. And somehow it seems like I am now better able to accept everything going on, even though some of it is just, it's unpleasant, including the physical pain or the fears. But it's not all life is. And Alexandra, one of the things she's doing, she's being a really stickler for, and I'm being a little bit slow about it. She wants me to learn how to smile for no reason. Just smile for no reason. I'd be over the top of this stuff enough that I can just smile no matter what the hell's going on. And this is a much more difficult chore than I thought Dr. Fred would have to deal with ever. It's like I found myself, yeah, but I can't breathe. Or yeah, but I don't know where my next check is coming. Or yeah, but. And therefore, a frown becomes the standard default. But the idea of smiling for no reason, really, I see how available that it is. And that it would make a huge difference for me to just take that stand and smile for no reason over and above all life's troubles. It would almost represent that I really am taking everything in, including fears of death or worries or concerns about the community or you know, deception or corruption, things that I've been a pretty serious stickler for in my life. Can I just let them soak in? And I think that when you start seeing me being able to smile for no reason, really, it'll represent that I am over the top, that I see the value of all of life being exquisite rather than judging the painful or uncomfortable parts of life as being less you know, less important or less beautiful than the comfortable parts of life.
Wow.
There you go.
There it is. Want to take a little break before we come back?
Let's do that. Let's come back. Well, let's go on with the commercial. Thanks, Doug. Hello, everybody. It's Dr. Fred again. I wanted to explain to you a little bit about one of the names I have called the Undoctor. What is the Undoctor? Well, after about 15 years in the field of me being misaligned with what I was doing, because I was medicating people even knowing that medications were not the right answer, and I was diagnosing people even though I didn't always believe that they had the diagnosis that I said that they had, even though they did meet the criteria, etc.,
I like seeing humans for exactly who they are and who they're not, and not as a diagnosis. So in 2006, I began the process of becoming the undoctor. I unmedicated, undiagnosed, and then undoctrinated a bunch of people. Like, people no longer had to come to a psychiatrist because their condition's cleared. This isn't true for everyone. It may not be true for you, but for some folks who know that their diagnosis doesn't fit and who know that they don't want to keep going through with medications and don't want to be seen as someone who's defective or afflicted, this turned out to be a great intervention. Over time, I stopped doing that, and I no longer do a whole lot of conventional psychiatry. Now I just help people walk through their life and find their true voice. I connect with people straight up, not as if there's a power gradient between a doctor and a patient, but as two humans connecting and resonating with each other. As it turns out, that's where all healing emanates from. So today, I've developed the Welcome to Humanity brand over the last 6 or 7 years, and that really takes into consideration all of this. It is self-explanatory. Basically, each and every experience that we have with humanity is just as exquisite as another, even if it's deeply uncomfortable. From there, we get to actually share these human experiences. From there, we get to resonate and connect, and from there, healing takes place. I also have been helping people with their true voice, and that's why you're here today at True Voice with Dr. Frey. I help people find that true voice, really their authentic self, their core value system, and then deliver it effectively into a world that is eagerly awaiting to hear you. Without your voice, no one will ever hear you. And without your true voice, no one will ever know you. But with your true voice, you can find healing, peace, and love. True voice is what it takes to end all wars. So, welcome to True Voice with Dr. Fred.
Okay.
As I was listening to your voice during the break there, there's one line really stood out. Each experience is just as exquisite as the next, even if it is deeply uncomfortable. Exactly. Boy, you were really pushing the boundaries of that philosophy, weren't you?
Yeah, exactly. I think so. And, you know, I have to be a stand for that. It's like, that's just true, you know. If you're going to smile for no reason, that you need to know that's true. It's all
good. Tell us about the exquisite aspects. We've heard about the pain and the discomfort and the struggle and all of the things that are quite obvious that you have experienced it, or no human being wants to have to go through. But what's exquisite so far? What's coming through for you that's exquisite? Or is it too early to be able to really mine this?
I don't think it's too early. I think the exquisiteness, like the other night, 2 nights ago, I was having trouble opening my chest. Just was painful. I was trying to lie down on my back. And the blankets, we have a whole blanket set up and, you know, trying to make it all work. And I found myself in a position that was unlikely to lead to sleep, but almost like a yoga level of discomfort. Probably wasn't going to sleep, but I could feel the value of it. And that was this corpse position thing. What's it called again? Savanasana or something?
Shavasana.
What is it?
Corpse position. This is a yoga pose. Are you talking about Shavasana?
Shavasana, I think.
Shavasana.
Isn't that similar to corpse position?
I've seen Shavasana as being sort of just lying there, you know, I suppose it's sort of a dead position. It's just exactly. Kind of lying in a relaxed position. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the same, you know, it's like your knees can be up, you're on your back, your arms are open, and you're just wide open to the world, having finished your yoga session or whatever. Mm-hmm. So Shavasana is what it's called. So I was lying there And then something, maybe something that you and I have talked about before, came up, like, I've really had a full life, and being this man who I am right now is deeply exquisite. Like, I get, like, you know, the guy who invented healing the healer, and now I'm like the poster child for what that looks like. You know, my credentials for being one who can at least speak to what it means to be healed as a healer. On the back end of the 30,000 patients that I've had who've been suicidal, or where I've been in the hospital, and where I've been in medicine, and where I've been in the world, I started realizing that the cure, and I'm reading Tony Robbins' book with Peter Diamantis, this Life Force book, beautiful book. And I'm actually only half a degree of separation from Peter Diamantis right now, which is also really interesting. Super interesting how I found myself now about a half a degree or less from Peter. I started realizing that the cure for depression is in my midst. Like, the actual cure for this condition that otherwise gets called depression is what I now can bring to the table. And what it is comes from this courage to accept all of life's experience as being exquisite. All of it, including this super painful, nasty, unacceptable, unspeakable, treacherous trauma, you know, undesirable. When one's soul can hover over the top of that and get that that too is just another version of an experience, undesirable as it is, so that being undesirable doesn't decrease the value of the experience itself. Simply being undesirable does not change the value of having the experience. Like, how you're doing is usually some version of, are you having more desire in your life than non-desire? But if one can get that the entire smorgasbord table has portions of it that are literally, you know, completely undesirable, and that they too shape who we are as humans, then that is what's required to defeat depression. Because then the whole idea that we might be wanting or expecting the world to be different than it is would naturally dissolve. We would get that the world is what it is, and therefore depression would disappear in that mode immediately as an option. I have it that depression is simply the distance between how the world is and how we wish it should be. And that distance would go to zero if we could understand that how the world is how it should be.
is recognizing that the world is how it should be, is the feeling of it is not the way it should be a prerequisite for recognizing that it is the way that it should be?
Is the feeling that say that again?
Is the rift a prerequisite to the acknowledgement that it is the way that it should be in your mind?
No, I don't think so. I think that it's a potential trigger to invite us to pursue that. That when you hear yourself asking, you know, is this the way it should be? Understanding that there's a possibility that this is exactly the way it is and therefore the way it should be is one of the tickets out of that rift.
I think I want to continue to mine this a little bit because this is deep stuff. It's really powerful. How do we then know that it is the way that it should be if there weren't an aspect of our consciousness that teases the idea that it might not be the way that it should be?
Yeah.
Is the contrast necessary, I guess, is what the question is.
I had somebody once discussing a topic of of the notion of all is well, which is a pretty similar notion, that all is well, all is well. And my question to that person, that was a leading mentor of mine at the time, was why isn't the opposite of well required in order to make that statement? You know, all is well compared to what? Like, you know, so I shorten the sentence to all is.
Yeah.
And taking out the judgment component of well.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when you, I sort of see this as a variant of that same question.
Yeah.
Like the way this
feels like a very honest and this perspective has a level of honesty in it, and even though it may seem maybe trite on the surface, there is something of great depth in it too, because it allows for possibility. Now, there's always the argument, if all is well, then can't we then look at, well, how are we defining well? What is this well thing that we're talking about? And are the, you know, slaves in Africa who are mining the cobalt for our cell phones and making no money doing so, would they consider that well? Is that well? Are the, you know, people in Ukraine who have no drinking water and no heat, is that well for them? Well, it would be somewhat crass for us to jump to that conclusion, but all is leaves an opening for, no matter what is occurring in one's life, there is an opportunity for the acceptance of that experience, no matter how painful or beautiful it might be. Mm-hmm. And to remove the lens of contrast that would suggest that there is one thing, that there's something that could be better in that moment than what is actually happening.
Right. Right. Exactly. That's the contrast, is that, you know, it's a really good question. I mean, if you're talking about the African slaves or people who are being abused one way or another, or living less than desirable qualities of life at the moment, or maybe horrendous qualities of life, if you ask them if all is well, then it sounds very arrogant for any of us living in this world that we live in to suggest that that's the way it should be, or that all it is. But the word should and the word well are the words that are up for grabs here.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we're going to do anything about any of that, coming to grips with that being what's so is the ticket to get that done. And it's not a judgment. It's not a judgment necessarily to come to grips with that. If we come with just all is, it seems like we have an opportunity to, like, roll in, this is what's so, you know, this is just what's so, and therefore the place to play in, the place to be with, the things to know about life, the, you know,
yeah.
I get worse and better become words that can get trounced on in this configuration.
Yeah, and all of these things can also sort of imply a sort of a tacit acceptance of things that are not acceptable to, and that, I think it's important to not include that in it, you know, that it's not about tacit acceptance. It's about a different type of orientation. And I've played with this orientation a lot through my own life, through, you know, my 2+ years of being immobilized in hospital beds and, you know, everything else that I've been through, this place of, okay, well, it's clear that I need to let go of my expectations that things be different and learn how to give my acknowledgement and even perhaps my love to what is happening versus what I wish were happening, while simultaneously getting that tacit acceptance without any kind of initiation to make anything different is also not the direction either. So it's kind of, it's sort of juggling in a way a certain principle with another principle.
Right. Yeah.
The principle of non-action with the principle of action. It's kind of the principle of Wu Wei in Taoism is about, it's really about non-action coming from a place of full deep acceptance of what is, and simultaneously getting that acceptance also paradoxically makes whatever action is taken highly deliberate, because it comes not from a place of conflict or fight, but from a place of pure awareness of what is appropriate in terms of the next movement.
So, one of the most beautiful things I've ever heard you say, so thank you. And Alexander told me today that I could learn from you. I think we all can. You know, and there's something here about, and it is not a matter of just buttering you up here. It's a matter of, you know, by acknowledging that interface of accepting unacceptability as being acceptable is almost what you're speaking to. Like, there are some things that are simply unacceptable, and accepting those as being acceptable in some version is what then creates that natural deliberation. As a possible way of managing that from a from an initial deep space of not fighting against, or not trying to eliminate, or not respecting some portion of what's so that needs attention, and can get that attention deliberately in a best way by simply being honest with the notion that it's real, and therefore its quality. If all things real are beautiful, you know, if all things real by definition are beautiful, then that certainly includes the things that are otherwise unbeautiful by some ways of measure, that those too are beautiful if it's what's so. Just by simply being in the what's so category leaves it to be reckoned as beautiful automatically. Yeah. So the unacceptable becomes acceptable and even beautiful. And once we get there, I think maybe that's how, that's, you know I can only imagine you being, you writhing around in your bed with your bed sores and your fucking pain, and you're, you know, being immobile and trying to figure out a way to love that situation. I don't know how you did it, but in some ways that's the only thing left to do in that point to get through. I don't know. Maybe you can speak a little bit to your memory or your experience of what that, how does that get initiated?
It reminds me of your comment earlier from Alexandra about learning to smile for no reason. Getting that there's only a certain amount, that aspect of ourselves that wants to fight with the circumstances is not the whole self. I think that was one of the more powerful lessons that I got from, or that I've continued to get from, very, very challenging experiences on a regular basis, that even that aspect of the self that is desperately feeling like, I do not fucking deserve this. This is some bullshit. And this is, I've been given a shitty card here. And that even that is not the whole self, that it's an aspect of our consciousness that has its own voice, and its voice is perfectly valid, and it makes sense, and but it operates in this sort of relativistic perspective of comparison of my experience versus the other's experience, my experience versus the person who, you know, is the imaginary version of me, or the other people who are like me, who are not stuck in this situation or whatever. It operates from a place of comparison, and it's a useful function in many respects, because it helps us to define ourselves. It helps us to move in the direction of our desires. It helps us to avoid things that we don't want to. It helps us to avoid pain and attract opportunities. It does all sorts of incredibly functional things. But when it gets put in that position where it feels like it's backed up against a wall, then it can become louder and louder and louder and more dominant in our imagination. But the thing to remember is it's still an aspect of our imagination versus the whole self. It will never will be the whole self. It never can be the whole self. It can only be an aspect of the imagination with a really loud voice convincing us that it must be the self because it's just fighting for what it feels that it deserves. And hey, let's love that part too. Let's love the part of us that fights for what it thinks it deserves. Good job, part of us that fights for what it feels that it deserves. We need that. We need that part of us. We also need to remember that that isn't all of us.
Yeah. Again, beautifully said, Sam Norris. I think, I don't feel like I'm have much that's larger or additive to what you're saying, other than we've had a lot of great conversations in our past, and I'm not sure we've had one from this perspective of me now somehow feeling like I have license to speak from this level of despair or pain or discomfort or worry or uneasiness or something.
Yeah, you burn your stripes, man.
Yeah,
I
got this motherfucking stripe right down the middle.
Right down the center. I saw that stripe. It's a big friggin' stripe.
Nice stripe. Except I do have a
that big... is one hell of a scar. Yeah. Two scars, yeah?
Yeah, two scars.
But running this... clear down your center.
Yeah, it's big and nasty and full, and it's a badge of honor, but it's also a mark of an injury, a scar of what, you know, almost like, what do we call it? Like a, there's an entry here, you know, as I heal and become stronger, as I lose weight, as my blood pressure is under control, as my chest becomes more functional. Last night I slept on my left side for 4 hours comfortably. And that was just like such an achievement. You know, I was so happy about it. And I start realizing that this is almost like an initiation scar of now I get to speak to this part of life too.
The light enters through the cracks.
What is that?
The light enters through the cracks.
That's right. And that's what's here.
You picked a good place to crack open, right there through your heart chakra. Right. Let the light through.
So that's what's here. Yeah. Mm. All right. For the listeners who have heard this, thank you for hanging on. I hope that brought some degree of awareness or some degree of comfort or some degree of compassion for your own life as well as for mine and or Sam's. But really, it's about you. Who is this real you here? And in some ways, isn't it interesting how much you can relate to me, even though it's highly unlikely that you've had the same event? And I feel the same way when I'm speaking to Sam. It's always super interesting that I can relate to him, but I've not been paralyzed physically for one moment in my life. We all relate to each other. These injuries are all of ours. And I took one for the team a couple weeks ago. I'm not sure that it's not just that it wasn't simply my aorta that burst, but maybe everyone's got unmitigated high blood pressure as a community. So take this as you will and, you know, move in the direction of making more sense of your life and bringing more love, compassion, acceptance, forgiveness, understanding, and to yourself and others, because that's all you really have. I'm Dr. Fred. You can find me at my link tree is linktr.ee/FredMoss. Or you can email me at drfred@welcometohumanity.net. I'll be glad to speak with you. Well, drfred@welcometohumanity.net, actually. Sam, how can people find you?
You can find me at zenwarriortraining.com or email me at sam@zenwarriortraining.com.
Awesome. Beautiful. Thanks for a very beautiful conversation, Sam. Thanks for being my bud. Thank you,
Fred. I'm glad you're still alive and well and more to come. I'm excited for this next chapter.
Thank you.
All right, brother.
All right. And thank you. Thank you, Doug. And we'll catch y'all next week. Hello, everybody, and I just wanted to thank you for getting through another episode of True Voice with Dr. Fred. Wasn't that great? It is so much fun to interact with people and then interact with my listenership about really finding True Voice and then bringing it forward. I really have never done anything more important than this, and I'm finally aligned with myself by helping others find their True Voice. Let's find your alignment. What do you really want in your life?